Sie hören SBS German.
You might remember the film Schindler's List, Christian. It started in Steven Spielberg filmed in 1993. And when he was on the set, survivor came up to him, a Holocaust survivor at Auschwitz-Birkenau, where he was filming. And she said to him, "Mr. Spielberg, I don't want to just tell you about this one day in my life that I arrived at Auschwitz. I want to tell you the fact that I had a life before and I had a life after. I want to tell you my whole story." And that's where the idea came from. What would it be like to give the chance for every survivor of the Holocaust to tell their entire story?
Wie viele Interviews wurden weltweit dann geführt? How many interviews were or testimonies were collected worldwide?
About 50,000 were collected at the beginning of this project, and since then another 5,000. So today, the what's known as the USC Shoah Foundation, which is the University of Southern California Shoah Foundation, has 55,000 testimonies in total. Put them all together, it would be 13 and a half years, 24 hours a day, and you'd have to speak 42 languages to understand the archive.
In wie vielen Ländern wurden Leute interviewt, Holocaust survivors, Holocaust Überlebende, in how many countries?
In 36 countries initially. Subsequently, we've extended that now to over 40 countries. Sorry, I apologize. 56 countries. So it's a remarkable, global archive.
Was waren so ein bisschen exotische Länder oder Orte, an denen Interviews geführt wurden?
Well, I think you Japan's very interesting because you wouldn't think of Japan as being a place that you would go to take testimonies. But there was a remarkable Japanese diplomat. His name was Senpo Sugihara, and his widow, who was with him the time he was rescuing Jewish people in the Holocaust, was living in Japan. So that's a really interesting place to go to take testimony. But also, I don't know if we count Australia as being exotic, but hundreds and hundreds of testimonies taken here. And it's very interesting that so many Holocaust survivors made their way from Europe after the Second World War to Australia. And we have a remarkable collection of testimonies that were taken here.
Das waren ja 2- bis 5-stündige Video-Interviews, die damals geführt wurden in den 90er Jahren. 2- to 5-hour testimonies that were recorded in the 1990s. Is there such a thing as a typical Holocaust survivor?
Well, when we think about the Holocaust, very often what will come to mind is the person that was, a young person that was in a ghetto, was transferred from a ghetto to a concentration camp, maybe a death camp like Auschwitz, and then went on a death march somewhere and eventually survived in a sub-camp of another place like Bergen-Belsen or Terezin. When you look at the archive, though, of over 50,000 testimonies, what you find is there is no typical story. They are very varied, from children that were given away to Christian families and lived in the countryside, through to people that were working in munitions factories for the entire time, folks that lived in ghettos for the entire time, or were in hiding, or joined the resistance, or the partisans. And so the multiple ways in which Jews survived or found means to survive is really remarkable and continues to amaze me 25 years later.
Wir wissen, dass über 6 Millionen Juden Opfer der Nazi-Verfolgung wurden. More than 6 million Jews did not survive the Holocaust. In the death camps, did you also interview those who weren't victims, who weren't Jews, but who were maybe perpetrators even, or people working in those camps?
Well, we have quite a variety of experiences of people who had, for example, they might have been victims of the Nazis who were not Jewish. They might have been political prisoners, for example, or people who were involved in resistance, as well as a whole variety of liberators, including Soviet soldiers in the Red Army and liberators from American and British forces.
So those were interviewed as well?
These were interviewed as well at the same, as part of the eyewitness experience of the Holocaust itself. We have not directly interviewed perpetrators, although I had a very interesting experience a few weeks ago. I interviewed the first member of the Hitlerjugend, of the Hitler Youth. In fact, she was in the Bund Deutscher Mädel, she was in the BDM, and she was 4 years old when Hitler came to power and 16 when the war ended. And so her entire childhood childhood memory was that of growing up in Nazi Germany and truly believing that the Führer would, you know, ultimately be successful, and was completely crushed at the end of the war when it was clear that was not happening. And she talks very honestly about what it meant to be sort of brainwashed in this entire culture, only to have to rediscover herself afterwards. A very interesting interview.
Did she admit knowing what was happening to the Jews, or was she also sheltered from that ultimate truth?
Well, it was interesting because her father worked on the Deutsche Railway. So she realized somewhere in around about 1943, 44, that her father was bringing home a lot of interesting new objects, including silver objects and artwork, and from the station. And she started to wonder, where did that come from? And then later on, because she was familiar with the railway station, she would cross the tracks to get home from school, because she was, you know, a railway child effectively. And one day there was a set of cattle wagons in a small town called Malchow, outside of, you know, north of in Mecklenburg, and there were a set of cattle wagons and women standing outside of them with striped uniforms. That was about 6 months before the end of the Second World War, and that was the moment she realized, oh, maybe the rumors are true.
SBS Radio am Montagabend mit einem Studiogast Stephen Smith, Executive Director der Shoah Foundation in Los Angeles. Was bringt Sie nach Australien?
I'm here because I've been working at the Jewish Holocaust Museum in Melbourne, where a beautiful new museum is going to be built in the next couple of years, and urge everybody to go and see that when it opens in 2022, I believe it is, and giving an oration for Kristallnacht, a November pogrom commemoration which took place last weekend. And I was very pleased to be able to reflect with the community in Melbourne about what that event has come to mean now, 81 years later.
Warum machen Sie das alles? Why are you doing this? It's a very, very heavy topic to devote decades of your career.
I came from a Christian family in England, with no connection to the Holocaust, and, you know, just the usual Second War, distant relatives that were involved. And so for me, actually, it began on a trip to Israel when I began to put together the understanding that to understand Christianity, you really need to understand Judaism. And as I try to look at how to do that and to learn from the Jewish faith, I discover that anti-Semitism has been a very vicious force within West European civilization and within the Christian world for many years. Oddly, I thought that maybe the Holocaust and the anti-Semitism of the mid-20th century would see an end to that. And of course, anti-Semitism has continued in many forms. And so I began to think, how do we as a society confront the past, that is, the happenings of the Holocaust, but in a way in which we can really think about how we should change our own society and our own values today to make sure we're not just saying never again, but actually saying, what do we have to do to create a world which is safe for everyone? And so that's my motivation. And the Holocaust survivors and their testimonies, it's so amazing. They talk for hours about their lives and what happened to them. But you don't hear revenge, and you don't hear bitterness, and you don't hear hatred. What you hear is this sense of, this is my past. Now let's think about what our future is going to be. And I find that so admirable. And I want to make sure those voices are heard in the world.
Haben Sie in diesen 50.000 Videos, die gesammelt wurden weltweit, auch so etwas entdeckt wie Survivor Guilt? Gibt's das auch bei Holocaust-Überlebenden?
So there is such a thing as survivor guilt. You know, I interviewed a lady, in fact, a film about her is playing right now at the Jewish International Film Festival. Her name was Sarah Shapiro. A beautiful film called My Name is Sarah, and it's playing in Melbourne and Sydney and Perth right now. It was troubling to talk to her because on the surface, it looked like she had an easy experience. Her parents sent her out of the ghetto. She was living in the Ukraine to a family that they paid in advance in case they needed to get their children to safety. They left that place and she worked as a maid for 2.5 years. She was nowhere near a concentration camp or a death camp. And so it looked like, oh, that's an easy story. But she carries two burdens of guilt. The first is she had to separate from her brother because she said, if you get caught because you're circumcised, we'll both die. And so she said, we have a better chance of survival if we split. They split, and he was caught and killed. And she feels the burden of his death. The second thing was she was working as a maid under a Ukrainian name. So she took on an identity of a former schoolmate of hers who died. And what happened was a Jewish girl came to the home and said, can you help me? And she said, I can't help you. You have to leave. And then 2 days later, she heard about the rape and murder of that young woman and also felt she was responsible for her death. Thirdly was she was the only survivor of her family, and so she feels like she survived, you know, on false pretenses and found it extremely difficult to live with those memories.
Sie hören SBS Radio am Montagabend mit einem Studiogast, Stephen Smith aus den USA, ein gebürtiger Brite, der seit vielen, vielen Jahren, ich glaube seit Anfang der 90er Jahre, für die Shoah Foundation arbeitet. You work now for almost 30 years for the Shoah Foundation.
No, I've worked for 30 years in the field of the Holocaust studies, and I've been at the Shoah Foundation for 10 years now in Los Angeles.
Okay. Now, all that material, it's an enormous amount of data. How is it collected? How is it stored and made available to the public?
So it is an enormous amount of data. It's thousands and thousands of hours. So what we do, we have a repository in Los Angeles at the University of Southern California where we preserve that content. Most of us don't realize that digitization is not preservation. We stick our photos and our films and so forth onto hard drives and we think that we've preserved them. But in fact, that material, that is also very vulnerable and it's rotting itself. So what we do, we check every single file every 3 months and we move it from one computer to the next. And we have 4 repositories around the world. We take great care over these testimonies. The second thing is we index them. We go through every testimony minute by minute and we put keywords in every minute. That means if you're looking for a story of a children living in the Warsaw Ghetto in 1943 who went to school, you can use those keywords and narrow it down from 55,000 testimonies to, say, 20, where people talk about being in school in the Warsaw Ghetto in 1943. So you're able, as a researcher, to really refine your research. For access, we provide access to over 160 universities worldwide that have the full archive. But you can also watch it on YouTube. If you go to the USC Shoah Foundation on YouTube, we have thousands and thousands of people watching every day there. And we have a school's website called iWitness, letter I, Witness. And on iWitness, students around the world, millions of students around the world, work in over 20 languages with different testimonies. So it means a teacher in Poland can teach using the Polish testimonies that even might be about the town or even the school that they're in. So we can narrow it down very closely. We're just working with a school in Cottbus right now in Germany. And there's just, I think, 5 testimonies from the town of Cottbus. But of course, each of those people are talking about landmarks and places and streets that the children in the school themselves will recognize. And so that's a really interesting way to localize it by language and geography.
Gibt's auch Kritik an der Shoah Foundation? Are there also people who believe it's not good what you're doing?
You know, we get very little criticism. I think there's, you know, there's always a question of, you know, is it real history? Like, what about documentary history? You know, there's a very sort of formal school of documentary historians who are not certain about how accurate testimonies are or how valuable they are in addition to as an alternative to traditional sources. The way we see it is that this is an additional source. And so what we're trying to do is build literacy skills among our users to be able to look at documentary sources and look at testimony and bring them together and enhance the knowledge and enhance the way which we understand the past. What is what people do believe is very powerful, though, is that the personal insight, and we get no criticism on this, the personal insight of what it meant and what it felt to be in that situation, to see the history from the inside out, is a valuable thing always to have.
Das finde ich interessant. Also es gibt Leute, die vielleicht sagen, wie können diese Überlebenden, die vielleicht nicht mal wissen, was sie heute zum Frühstück gehabt haben, wie können die wissen, was vor 75 Jahren, vor 80 Jahren, vor 85 Jahren passiert ist? You understand the question?
So yeah, I think that for one thing about memory over time, and I studied this actually for my own PhD research, how testimony changes over time. And what we found is that you have, if you look at a testimony from the 1940s, you might only have two pages. And the bare facts are laid out there. When you get to the 1990s, or even to now, and the same survivor is writing a 250-page book, what you find is those string of facts don't change. They're always there. What happens is time allows more reflection. Time allows you to build up reflections on my family and my community and what I lost and what it means to me. And so the testimony, therefore, is more full later on. But the facts don't change very much. I think also facts that are... And memories that are made in traumatic situations, we would use the word, I think, in American English, are very sticky. They stay with you, and they are very, very impressionable. And I think that's true of many of our memories. If you think about the things you remember from childhood, it's those extraordinary events. They could be extraordinarily happy or extraordinarily sad or surprising. They're the things, the mundane doesn't stick with you. That's why I do forget about my breakfast, but don't forget about those meaningful moments in my childhood where something wonderful or maybe tragic happened.
Ein letzter Gesprächsblock mit Stephen Smith, Executive Director der Shoah Foundation in Kalifornien, hier in Australien zu Gast für ein paar Tage. Er versteht Deutsch oder fast alles, deswegen dieses Interview zum Teil mit deutschen, zum Teil mit englischen Fragen. Eine Kritik ist ja auch, dass die Juden nicht die einzigen Opfer des Nationalsozialismus waren. Natürlich, sie wurden systematisch verfolgt und letztlich getötet. Aber es gab auch andere Opfer, Schwule, politische Verbrecher und so weiter. Sie tragen diesem Umstand Rechnung, indem Sie den Begriff Survival ausgedehnt haben auf andere Genozide. Und da fällt mir ein, Ruanda.
One of the things that struck me, I was building the UK Holocaust Centre in the 1990s. I'd come to confront the past of the Holocaust, including you know all of the victims of that of National Socialism, and there seemed to be a very universal lesson here that what we learn from the past we have to apply in the future. And while I was building the Holocaust Centre in the United Kingdom, genocide happened in Rwanda. You know, it's very easy for us to look back at the past and say, well, this shouldn't happen again. But it's much more difficult when it's occurring in the present to react and to be able to provide a meaningful response. So now we have this situation where we're sitting here, you know, looking back on Rwanda and interviewing survivors all over again. My disappointment around these particular testimonies is that I wish that they had never had to be taken, because I think we could have prevented the Rwandan genocide. And I don't think these survivors needed to have survived genocide. So I think the big warning here for me when I listen to these particular testimonies is, have we really learned the lesson in a way in which we're prepared to apply it?
What are the lessons?
You know, I was looking at a book recently. It was printed in 1936. It's called The Yellow Spot: The Extermination of Germany's Jews. Now think about the publication date, 1936. What had happened was a project was launched to look at what's the impact on the Jewish people, 1933 to 1935, of the new laws that are coming in and the propaganda and so forth. And the only conclusion that the authors could draw was there was no way that the Jews of Germany could survive. So we look back on it and say, well, we didn't see that coming. We didn't know it was happening and so on. And yet there it is in print. So part of my belief is that the lessons are that if we actually act earlier and we look more carefully, and we, most importantly, I'd rather listen to people that may become victims of genocide and hear what they have to say so that they can be advocates for their own cause rather than have to speak to them after when all of their families have been murdered. So, for example, 2 weeks ago, I was in northern Iraq. I went there following the change of situation after Trump and Erdogan and Putin made their arrangement, because as soon as I heard that, as a genocide scholar, my alarm bells go off, because I say, okay, if a belligerent country is coming into a piece of territory where 400,000 Kurdish people are living, that doesn't look good for the Kurds. It doesn't mean that genocide will take place, but what I wanted to do was say, let's listen to the Kurds themselves, not just make determinations about their lives, because maybe they can tell us something we don't know and ring an alarm bell in time.
Back to Rwanda. Maybe for those listeners who weren't here when it happened in the mid-1990s, can you briefly tell us?
So in April 1994, there was a peace agreement being brokered between the extremist nationalist Hutu ethnic government in Rwanda and a warring party, which was a Tutsi-led mainly refugee army who had been pushed out of Rwanda because of ethnic conflict over two generations. When that agreement was signed, as the presidents of the country were returning, the plane was shot down, and suddenly, within an hour or so, a systematic attack on the Tutsi people began. It was obviously coordinated, it was obviously pre-planned, and over 100 days, almost a million Tutsis were murdered in the country of Rwanda by Hutus. It was led by a Hutu government, but included many, many hundreds of thousands of civilians who participated. It was organized, coordinated, and national. And so 3 months later, you know, it was very clear what had been described originally as a tribal war or a tribal conflict was a pre-planned genocide.
By what means were these people killed?
Most were killed by machetes. There were some guns, but what would happen is they would, the Hutu population basically set up roadblocks all around the country. And because everything was done at a very local neighborhood level, everybody knew everybody. So you couldn't leave your block, you couldn't leave your village effectively without passing through a roadblock where people would know you. So escape became extremely difficult. And also, prior to the genocide, the government had made civilians in Rwanda have identity cards with their ethnicity on it. So you were asked to produce your identity card. And obviously, if it had Tutsi on it, then if you didn't produce one, they assumed you were Tutsi. If you did produce one and it said you were a Tutsi, then you were, you know, in deep trouble.
Yeah. Now, the Jews in World War II, they by and large didn't fight back. That's a criticism that has been leveled at their address, of course, a bit unfair, given who was the perpetrator. Do you see in Rwanda that it was different there, that Tutsis participate in, did they fight back, basically?
This is such an interesting question in terms of both what happened with the Jews and what happened with the Rwandans. First of all, you see relatively small amounts of armed resistance during the Holocaust. What you see is very large amounts of personal points of resistance on a daily basis. And one of the things that the Shoah Foundation archive shows and reveals in a remarkable way is just how many acts of micro acts of resistance there were every single day. Because just the act of survival itself involved lots of decision making and lots of ways to, you know, outwit your enemy and survive. And I think if I've learned anything from the archive is just how resilient the Jewish people were in spite of their lack of ability to arm themselves and, you know, go out and fight. In Rwanda, you have a very similar situation. You have a population that has been excluded for many years and put in a position where they just don't have access to arms. But there were also a number of amazing examples. There's a place called Bisesero, and the men of Bisesero organized themselves around a mountain and basically put the women and children higher up on the mountain, and then they encircled it and they fought back. One of the largest massacres outside of the Holocaust period took place in a place called Morambi. And at Morambi, it was about somewhere more than 35,000 Tutsis were driven there, almost like a concentration camp. The mayor of the town said, go to this school for your own safety, but it was a way to get them all in one place. When the Hutus came to attack them, there are many records of the fact that the men organized themselves. It was a construction site, a building site. So they got the stones from the roadstone and they held off the Hutus for 2 days, just hurling rocks at them to try and protect their... And then they came back with weapons, heavy weapons, and stopped it. But those acts of resistance are extremely important to learn about and know about, because it's about the resilience of the human spirit.
Mm. Wir haben leider nicht mehr viel Zeit, aber so als letzte Frage noch, to your credit, die Shoah Foundation, you are now also recording those testimonies, the survivors of the genocide in Rwanda.
We are, and it's an important thing for us to learn from, because it happened in our own lifetimes, and we want those lessons to be, we aren't comparing human suffering. What we're saying is we all live in a world in which violence can occur and has occurred. What can we learn from each other? How can we apply those lessons in our world? Because actually we're trying to work towards a world in which there is less violence and less genocide, and we hope to learn from these lessons.
We certainly do. Vielen, vielen Dank, Stephen Smith, Executive Director der Shoah Foundation in Los Angeles. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lust auf weitere Interviews und Geschichten? Uns gibt's auf allen großen Podcast-Plattformen wie Apple, Google und Spotify.